And hello, I'm Stephanie Flanders, head of Bloomberg Economics and senior executive editor for economics at Bloomberg. And I'm delighted now at Bloomberg Invest Global to welcome Greg Jensen, the co-chief investment officer at Bridgewater Associates. We have so much to talk about, Greg. Thanks for joining us. I want to get straight to it. It feels like it's been a matter of weeks that we've gone from worrying about the pandemic and about lack of demand to worrying about supply shortages and possible stagflation. Is there a structural shift that has happened, or should we all just take a breath?
Well, I think it's been longer coming than that, Stephanie. First off, thanks for doing this. Basically, if you take the big thing that changed in this crisis relative to prior crises is the nature of the response by policymakers. That if you go back to the tech crash in 2000 or 2008, the first move is interest rates go lower. The second move in 2008, of course, is printing money to buy assets. But the move that occurred in this crisis was printing money to replace incomes. And that's essentially what we call monetary policy three, but the merger of fiscal policy and monetary policy. And this is an incredibly powerful weapon, much more powerful than interest rate declines, which create more credit. Through incentivizing credit in the private sector. Monetary policy two works through driving up asset prices, but that money seeps into the economy quite slowly. Printing money to make up for income losses is a whole different ballgame in the sense of it enters the economy, and it enters the economy without creating offsetting supply. Normally, when somebody gets income from working, they're creating supply and simultaneously demand. Getting demand created through money printing without offsetting supply is kind of the big thing that's been happening for a while. Now, over the last 6 months, 9 months, some of that is masked by the ability to run down inventories. But what you're seeing in the world today is we're out of most things. The inventories have been run down. And so you're starting to see the ramifications of demand without supply. Super powerful weapon that was super effective in maintaining pricing pressures, in essentially bringing the economy back at warp speed from what would have been a devastating hit. But it is a much more inflationary weapon than the tools that have been used before. And now we're living through that, right? And now the Fed is gradually accepting that. They want to stay behind. They will stay behind. They purposely learned a lesson in 2018 that Powell is committed to not repeating, which is tightening preemptively to inflation rather than lagging behind it. That has implications. The lagging behind it means the economy is going to continue to run these hot spots where very low real interest rates, housing everywhere in the world, and so on, and capital expenditures by corporations will pick up to very hot levels, and the Fed will be extremely slow. But what's happening in the economy is now what we'd kind of describe happening at warp speed. So you had policymaker response at warp speed, markets rebound in a rate much faster than any other crisis. And you're seeing the follow through in the economy. The economy is obviously slower than the markets, but happening at a rate we're just not used to. And so you're seeing us rush into the late cycle where there's not enough supply and there's a tremendous amount of still pent up demand. And that's, that's the circumstance. And in our view, that's gonna drag the Fed along. Those economic conditions, inflation staying higher than they expect, will pull them to tightening faster than they expect. And that's a big deal to markets because so much of the current asset price levels are a function of the liquidity and interest rate levels that we see today. And particularly assets that have benefited from the liquidity, assets that themselves don't produce cash flow to support them, but rather require new liquidity in order to support them. So any asset that's based on, no income, and is essentially not going to move with nominal GDP and inflation in terms of their income, those assets will probably be hit relative to the assets where you get some of the benefit from the surging nominal GDP that's occurred.
I mean, you talk about, it's an interesting point that we have a lot of things operating at warp speed, but certainly the real economy not operating like that. And we see it all the time. Our reporters are seeing that the container ships not operating at warp speed. Your point about the Fed is a good one. If the Fed is sort of realizing now it might have to go faster or at least remaining committed to its current path despite the nervousness in the markets, is it that, investors, have they just not got to grips with the fact that the Fed can't create semiconductor chips overnight can't magic up more container ships overnight?
Yeah, I mean, I think in part that's, you know, when we look at this, we've lived through a world where the problems the Fed faced were problems the Fed could resolve and have gotten really used to that in markets in the sense that 2008, the problem was there was not enough credit. This, the Fed can turn on the spigots of credit very easily and offset that, right? It was bold on their part relative to what they had done historically, but they're capable of offsetting credit with printing money. They were also capable of offsetting income by printing money in this thing. But what they're not capable of is creating the supply that would have been created that would normally have generated that income. And so you're seeing that, right? And what you're seeing is we're hitting policymaker constraints. We have a measure of policymaker constraints, and certainly you want to be more bullish on markets when policymakers are free to react to any downturn in the economy. When they're constrained, and basically there's three constraints that we see that can affect policymakers' ability to step in a problem. One is when that problem is inflationary, when it's essentially a supply side problem that demands above supply, they can't just easily step in and solve that problem. The currency problems as well, and bubbles in asset prices. And today the Fed faces certainly the problem of inflation being well above their target and the inability to be as easy as they'd like to be and being pulled along by that. And certainly the increasing odds that we're facing bubbles in certain areas. And so the third problem that would really force them to move is more of a currency problem. We haven't seen that yet. But those constraints put the Fed in a much different situation in terms of the nature of the problems we face than they were in 2008 or in the beginning of the COVID crisis.
I noticed there was an interesting column that Mohammed Al-Aryan wrote the other day for Bloomberg Opinion, which was making some of this point and just arguing that maybe we've got so used to focusing on lack of demand as being the key problem in the economy, we're not perhaps responding quickly enough to the fact that the world has changed and now it's a matter of supply. But look, I'm pulling out from what you're saying two things that are somewhat disturbing. The Fed's going to carry on regardless. In response to these conditions, and potentially inflation is going to carry on regardless, maybe higher than what is currently being priced in by markets. I mean, is that something that is going to cause a problem for investors down the road, the combination of those two things, tapering and continued high inflation potentially?
Well, to be clear, I think it's really the second that will drive the first, in the sense that the Fed won't taper if they don't need to, meaning that the only reason they're going to taper is because the inflation pressures don't go away. So if you do get some sort of downturn, or that we're wrong and somehow the supply comes online to match the current levels of demand, then the Fed will probably slow down. So there is a deflationary environment where the Fed slows down. The problem is more likely in our view.
But you're not seeing that.
Yeah, you're more likely. Exactly. More likely you have the inflation dragging the Fed along. And yeah, that's risky for investors. And so what can be done here? The big thing is that the only reason the Fed's going to tighten is if they have to. They're only going to have to if nominal GDP continues to increase at a rate that's driving inflation higher. And so you can hedge your portfolio much more than most portfolios are by trying to lock in cash flows in the real economy and go short things like treasuries, but basically arb the difference between the likely nominal GDP outcomes and the interest rate the Fed's currently giving you. We don't think they'll be able to give it to you for long. So those assets are in danger when you go through the tapering and interest rates rise. But today you could still get a good deal in hedging cash flows that are likely going to be higher than the interest rate. And so that's, you know, one of the things that we don't think enough portfolios have hedges to the main risk. The risk, in our view, to asset prices is not deflation. It's not the old risk, because we know what the Fed and policymakers will do in the end. If there's deflation, they'll print money and spend money, and that'll affect the prices of things. The problem is stagflation. That's the real risk. And so many portfolios are massively exposed. And there are ways to hedge that risk, to try to arbitrage that difference between the likely nominal outcomes and those available in financial assets today.
And you're obviously talking to a lot of institutional clients about that. I guess for the less sophisticated investor, they're looking at potentially a period where you have a positive stock bond correlation. It feels like there's nowhere to hide. What's your advice more broadly to people trying to think about what a balanced portfolio looks like in this environment?
Yeah, well, like you said, if that for institutional investors, the ability to try to at least hedge some of those risks and being short some assets while being long some assets is kind of step one. The other, but the geographic diversification is still available. The U.S. situation is different than the European situation, is different than the situation in emerging markets in China. And so much, 60% of global portfolios sit in U.S. assets, despite the U.S. economy being, only 20-25% of the world. So essentially, people are not even in a long-only kind of situation taking advantage of diversification. And these problems, the manifestation of inflation, the labor shortage in the U.S., those problems are very different than the problems China faces and very different than the problems Europe faces. So being at least somewhat better diversified geographically and as much as possible across assets, having some commodity exposure, having some equity exposure and being more balanced are the steps that everybody can take to deal with the wide range of possible outcomes today.
Well, of course, I've had a former life at JP Morgan where we spent a lot of time trying to get people to diversify, and it's a good strategy. But in the last few years, if you persuaded clients to go outside America, they tended to do less well than if they just stayed in America. But you think this is really a new environment now?
Well, I wouldn't say it's new in the sense that's always possible, right? You should never diversify get away from the best performing asset. Of course, you just don't know, right? Maybe somebody did know then, but the benefits of diversification, this is one of the reasons it works so well, is people tend to make that huge mistake of going into the asset that's done the best looking backward. If you look at the situation today, the U.S. is priced for perfection, right? There's a lot of challenges. Any way you look at the challenges in the U.S., you've got this essentially economy with strong inflation pressures, requiring a lot of fiscal policy, very low interest rates, paper wealth at extremely high levels relative to incomes. Lots of challenges. On top of that, of course, everybody's living the political conflict and the risks associated with that. And yet everybody's pouring in to U.S. assets based largely on the thing you're saying is for the last decade, that was by far the best thing. But if you look decade by decade, it's almost always true, like just super simple strategy of go short the equity markets that were that did the best in the last decade and long the ones that did the worst. That works by itself. I mean, I wouldn't recommend that as it's overly simplified. But the reality is the expectations for U.S. and U.S. technology are so extreme relative to the rest of the world, that not only does the U.S. have to massively outperform economically, it's got to outperform faster than it did over the last 10 years in order to outperform on a financial basis. So that's a huge deal, and it is different. The pricing is certainly radically different than it was 10 years ago. And the range of outcomes, who knows, maybe the U.S. just dominates everything and you go from 60% of assets in U.S. assets to 80%. But more likely, you go from 60% to something more in line with the US's relevance in the world.
Okay, we got that message. This time is different, says Greg Jensen. Look, if we go to one of those outside opportunities, China is a country, a market that Bridgewater's been very enthusiastic about in the past for many good reasons. We've had a pretty negative news flow out of China in the last few months and a lot of questions even about the investability of China. How are you seeing that? And what would it look like, do you think, for China to become uninvestable?
Yeah, well, a few things. I mean, everybody looks at the equity market, right? This is across all,
which has performed horribly.
All investors, right? But that's not really our perspective. We look at a balanced mix of assets and what could you do in China, right? So a balanced mix of assets in China, if you include China equities, China bonds, commodities, et cetera, is up steadily this year. So yes, stocks are down because policymakers have made decisions balancing several goals that they have. They have goals for common prosperity. They have goals to make sure that information security and that no company becomes more important than the party. They have goals also of becoming a world superpower for which they recognize they need to be an investable financial center. And they're going to be. They've been moving in that direction over the last 25 years, step by step. Every once in a while, whether it's 2015 or whatever, they take a step backwards to achieve some other goal related to stability. And you're seeing one of those. But I would not extrapolate that to mean they're moving away from building financial markets that compete globally, that attract capital, because they recognize that every superpower has always had them. Their plan is to be a superpower, and they're moving consistently in that direction. So we do think it's investable. The health of those markets can somewhat be shown by the fact that the balance between assets has worked as it always does in other, as it has normally in other countries, and in fact is more reliable today in China than in the US and Europe, because interest rates are at a more normal level. So when stocks do go down, bonds rally in a more predictable way than, let's say, in the United States today. So those are the issues, right? But unquestionably, there's regulatory risk in China. They are building, they don't have the rule by law setup that we have in the West. They're coming up with the laws today and sort of doing what we'll call rule of law, but they don't have a structure for how to deal with these companies, the profitability of these companies. That's all happening on the fly. And that's messy and certainly create nerve-wracking situations for investors. But if you look at that, a lot of that is priced in. I mean, the same asset in China relative to the US is probably at a 40-45% discount in terms of if you're looking at reasonably similarly expected cash flows. So maybe that should be worse. Maybe that should be better. Our basic point would be you're still better off having a diversified mix of Chinese assets with US assets. And that's been the case, again, recently, even in this year, if it's not an all equity-based investment.
Well, and the bond market has certainly done well. But I guess the wild card, which could overturn the analysis that you've just given, is this potential for U.S.-China relations to just deteriorate drastically. You've got the Chinese authorities actually discouraging Chinese companies from listing in the U.S. You have, I noticed, the Commerce Secretary last week, Gina Raimondo, saying that the U.S. needed to rally its allies to slow down China's rate of innovation. This feels like quite a potentially a difficult situation for investors, surely.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's difficult on both sides. That's not bullish for U.S. assets either. That the fact that we're moving from a collaborative world to a competitive world between China and the U.S., not that it was all collaborative before, nor is it all competitive today, but it's certainly transitioning in that direction. And economically and financially, who will win? Like, there is... that's a big question. I don't think it's clear in terms of that. And having some balance in terms of a portfolio is a big deal. But you're right, it's going to be competitive. Hopefully it won't come to war per se, but that it is a competitive situation. And that is going to change things a lot. That is part of the supply chain story. That's part of the U.S. needs China. China needs the U.S. And you're seeing it when China's struggling to meet production demand, and they don't have the electricity to do it because production demand surged during COVID from China. Now it's at levels that they can't simultaneously meet those production and their goals on climate. So now you have a constraint that's hitting the whole world, right? And that those risks flow back and forth between China and the U.S. It's not just China that will suffer in terms of financial consequences from those challenges.
I mean, I want to get to a final question, but just to go back on that, I'm intrigued. I mean, as an investor who's so active in China, do you find that unhelpful when a U.S. Commerce Secretary says something like that? I mean, if you can imagine if a Chinese official said, we want to slow down U.S. innovation, that would cause uproar in the U.S.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just our reality, right? Like, this is the world we're in. We're in this competitive world, so I don't see it one way or the other. I do think that's more a reflection of something everybody already knew than something brand new. And so I think that reflection, that is it. We're going to split the technological world. We're going to split up in these ways, and managing a portfolio that is acceptable given the range of ways that might play out is a big deal. That what if it plays out in a hot war? What if it plays out in terms of dividing these supply chains up? Who's going to benefit? Who's going to lose? Now, there's a lot that's unknowable, but the best tool in our view to deal with that wide range is not to take a lopsided bet on just it being great for the U.S. and bad for China or vice versa.
Okay, we are out of time, but I want your 10-second answer to Amy Koh, who from HSBC in Hong Kong, who wants to know what growth sectors you see in 2022. You've got 10 seconds.
Well, I think the big thing is the growth sectors are going to be the areas that benefit from this huge rise in nominal GDP that can essentially have the pricing that aligns with the inflation pressure and don't have the costs. I can't get into all of that, but that's where you'd be examining companies, both historically, how their pricing relative to their costs work in this type of supply constrained environment.
Greg Jensen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.